You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education edition review of 2nd of February 2017. My name's John Gill, I'm editor of THE and I'm here with Simon Baker, news editor, John Morgan, deputy news editor, and Eddie Bothwell, one of our reporters. This is obviously the second week of the Trump presidency, so we'll be talking about Trump and higher education and some of his more and less outrageous pronunciations so far. We'll be talking about our international university rankings, which we published this week, and we'll also be talking about the latest UCAS figures, which have some very interesting statistics on the rise and fall of different universities as the student numbers fluctuate. But first, let's talk about Trump. Who else? It seems like we're now in the news cycle where almost every story has a Trump angle, Simon. And I suppose this week we've had a couple of very large developments as far as higher education is concerned. The first being the travel ban, which obviously has huge implications for the flow of students and academics around the world, but also provoked a very strong reaction from academics and indeed student bodies around the world too. Would you like to just kick us off on the travel ban and then perhaps we'll move on to some of the developments that have happened in the last 24 hours?
Yeah, well, I suppose that was the kind of real big story to emerge over the weekend, the travel ban, and as well as all the protests that took place at airports in the US. There seems to be growing unrest on campuses in relation to this. Of course, how international higher education is, it was immediately apparent that something like this was going to affect higher education. There's not just the students and academics affected who were abroad at the time. There are the students and academics currently in the United States who may have been planning to travel back to their countries, who are now have second thoughts about that and how it affects them. There's the effect it has on students that might have been thinking about studying the US, who now may have to completely rethink their plans. And you know, it's also led to calls in this country and elsewhere, and I suppose in America as well, to boycott conferences in America. A lot of debate going on about whether that's a good idea, whether that's actually helping or hindering what's going on. But it's becoming really apparent that universities are kind of at the sort of forefront of the kind of war that's being sort of raged from a Twitter account against various, not just travel and immigration, but of course political correctness, freedom of speech. These are big issues for Trump and his advisors. It looks like campuses are going to be a major battleground.
Yeah, and we'll come on to a specific example of that in a moment. But I suppose one of the a couple of points to make. One is that university presidents and academics spoke in one voice against this travel ban. You know, it was a very unified position. But I mean, John, you're our sort of main political analyst. Do you think that sort of, you know, very cohesive response from higher education has any weight at all as far as Trump's concerned? Can universities and academics fight a rearguard action against this sort of thing?
Given the nature of his base of support, I think it's something he could pretty easily afford to ignore. As you say, was a remarkably unified response from university presidents, some really strong condemnation that this was totally in contradiction with universities' values and and in contradiction of US values. People like the Chancellor of the University of California system, Janet Napolitano, and Ron Daniels, the Johns Hopkins University president, some really influential, or you would think of as influential, people speaking out with strong voice, but unlikely to have much political impact, you would think, given that Trump is so reliant on white working class votes and didn't even win a majority of the vote in the popular vote, but it will have a big impact on US universities. Iran is the 11th biggest sending country to the US in terms of foreign students. I think it's a figure of about 30% for Nobel Prize winners in the US that are foreign born since the early 20th century. So, yeah, I think the right to speak out, this is a huge issue for US universities.
And one that I mentioned, the sort of how quickly things move on, it's one of the challenges, Simon, in actually covering a story. Well, Trump isn't exactly a story, is it? It's really tricky to cover anything that happens with Donald Trump because it all moves on so quickly. There's an almost hour-by-hour news cycle. It's a bit like trying to follow somebody that's just running along lobbing grenades left, right and centre, and you sort of barely, responding to the first explosion before another one goes off. And this morning we had him tweeting at 6 a.m. Washington time, presumably just woken up. He tweeted about, some grievances with Australia, some grievances with Iran, and then moved swiftly on to the University of California at Berkeley. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, to my knowledge, it's the first time one of his tweets that's becoming president seems to have targeted a particular institution. I mean, it's pretty kind of, it's a bit of a watershed moment. I suppose it was always going to happen, given the sort of kind of views.
Well, it didn't take long. 2 weeks?
No, it didn't take that long, no. It's pretty extraordinary what he said. Obviously, there was overnight, California time, there was a pretty violent kind of protest against the appearance by, I'm going to have to probably defer on trying to pronounce his name, Milo, who from Breitbart News, a technology editor, and he was going to give one of his talks under this pretty controversial figure, always provoking kind of outrage on the left by some of what he says, but he's a freedom of speech advocate in lots of ways because he tries to sort of just say these outrageous things and see if people react. But wherever he goes, he seems to court some kind of protest, and there was a violent protest at Berkeley. In the end, it got so bad that the university decided to sort of cancel the visit. Trump's kind of reacted by saying, well, okay, if you're going to cancel a visit, I might have to think about federal funds to Berkeley, and linking it to freedom of speech issues. I mean, I don't know the kind of rights and wrongs about what happened at Berkeley, but for a president to actually use federal funds as some kind of threat, really, on Twitter, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary if this is what's going to happen.
It's pretty staggering that a US president is threatening one of the world's best universities over a free speech issue involving one single far-right troll. Staggering on so many levels, and what it says about sort of the future of university autonomy in the US under the Trump administration must be pretty worrying. And obviously the US is the world's leading nation in higher education.
Yeah, and interesting that we had an interview recently with the president of MIT, Eddie, which you conducted, and he actually made the point that, the big threat from Trump, as he saw it then, was that, funding would be withdrawn for certain areas of research that Trump perhaps didn't agree with. I think he gave the example of climate change, and his point was that we're not going to stop doing research on climate change, we're just going to have to find alternative sources of funding. Well, that's an approach that probably works for the very wealthy universities in specific areas of research. Mm-hmm. Less effective if you're being threatened with the entire removal of federal funding. Unlikely it will ever happen, but as John says, absolutely extraordinary that this threat is even being made. Well, we'll move on from that. I mean, one thing I would say is that no doubt this story will have moved on considerably in the couple of hours it takes us to post this podcast live, so apologies if we're already out of date. Moving on to a second story, the International University Rankings, which we publish this week, very timely in a sense, because we're obviously highlighting the extraordinary global links of some of the finest universities in the world, Eddie. You've written the analysis on this. Our methodology has changed slightly this year on previous years, so we're getting a slightly more, a slightly different view of where the really international institutions sit. Could you just talk us through those changes and then give us some highlights from the analysis?
Yes, so in previous years, it's really just been a cut of our world university rankings. We've just been looking at the International Outlook Indicator, and so that takes into account a university's proportion of international students, proportion of international staff, and also the proportion of internationally co-authored publications. This time we've added another metric to that, So we're also looking at global reputation, and so that's kind of how many votes a university gets from our academic reputation survey, and that's, you know, to ensure that actually we are looking at universities that are kind of prestigious across the world. We're just including universities as well that are in the top 500 of our world rankings. So you can't really make comparisons with previous years, really, for the international ranking. But in terms of this year's results, sort of Switzerland leads the ranking. ETH Zurich is number one. And Ecole Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne is number two. And generally, you know, the kind of universities at the top tend to be in countries that are relatively small populations. They're very kind of export reliant, and also countries where English is either, you know, an official language or it's widely spoken. So Hong Kong, Singapore, the UK, Australia, Canada, also kind of appearing in the top 20.
But not the US. The US tends to do less well in this ranking than it does in many of the other analyses we produce of university performance.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, yeah, the US, you know, has some of the world's best universities. It kind of, when you just judge it on internationalisation, it doesn't do so well. I mean, part of that is just it doesn't tend to attract as many international students. Obviously, the US is a huge country and has a, you know, a huge talent pool, and maybe doesn't need to look outside as much in terms of students. Also, I think some of the state universities do have limits on the number of international students they're allowed to recruit. So, I mean, the US, though, it still has the most universities in this ranking. It has 64 in the top 150. Mm. So although it doesn't have any, you know, in the top 20, it still does have a lot of the most international universities in the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the US has, for several years, been spoken about as a sort of sleeping giant that was just about to get into the sort of international student recruitment game in a big way. Mm-hmm. That's been the, if you like, the threat hanging over places like the UK that have become very reliant on those international students. Maybe that won't be the case if Trump is taking a much more isolationist view. I mean, I said every story has to come back to Trump. Have you got any thoughts on what his impact might be on the further internationalisation of universities over there?
Yeah, I mean, it is something that I explored in my analysis. I mean, you'd think that it must have an impact on whether students go to, you know, a particular country. I mean, I know the Institute of International Education in the US has spoken before about this and said that actually rhetoric doesn't have so much of an impact as policy. So, you know, obviously the travel ban is something very specific that's happened, but maybe when there are specific policies around sort of immigration, maybe that will have more of an impact than just kind of his words that are kind of anti-immigration. I mean, I also spoke to Eric Thomas, who is the former Vice Chancellor at Bristol, and regarding the UK, he sort of said that he thought that, you know, he didn't think that globalisation would be on the retreat because of Brexit. He said, you know, it's too hardwired now. You know, universities, you know, are just so interconnected and focused on internationalisation. He kind of can't see that changing because of Brexit.
Mm. Okay, let's move on finally, John, to a story that we were actually, in the days when we weren't writing entirely about Trump, we wrote quite a lot about student number controls in the UK, and one of the massive changes that happened in 2011 when universities were suddenly able to recruit as many students as they wanted or were able to get. We're now obviously several years into that new system, and we've done an analysis based on this year's figures which looks back over that period of time and the universities that have really shrunk or expanded on the basis of those movements. Do you want to just talk us through what the numbers tell us?
So looking at the trend since 2011, which is when the government began to lift student number controls, before they were finally abolished completely in 2015, there have been some huge shifts in student numbers, and you can really see the emergence of a competitive market and universities fighting each other for students, and this means winners and losers, and the losers face quite severe financial consequences. So there's three universities: London Metropolitan, University of East London, and University of Cumbria and Kingston University, that have seen their numbers of new UK and European Union students fall by more than 40 by more than 30% since 2011. So this is looking at new figures on 2016 recruitment that were published by UCAS just recently. Mm. And you've got three universities, Aston, Coventry and the University of Surrey, who've grown their numbers by more than 50%. And it does seem like many of the biggest falls are in larger post-1992 universities, and those kinds of universities face pressure on a number of fronts. You've got the Home Office planning to differentiate between different types of universities in terms of their access to overseas students, and you've got Brexit as well creating uncertainty, and now Theresa May with a plan to create credible alternatives to university and the new institutes of technology. So there really are some big pressures on some universities, and they potentially face very serious financial consequences if they are losing students long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And would the view in government be that this is evidence of a policy that's working, that's applying pressure in a competitive marketplace in the way that they wanted it to?
I'm sure the plan to create a market will be seen as having operated effectively. The government would argue that the system should be directed by student choice, and in these shifts in numbers, arguably that's what you're seeing. And if you bring in the TEF, obviously the government's aim there is to provide more information about where the best kind of where the best teaching is, and that TEF wouldn't really operate if you still had a system of number caps. You have to allow students to move to where the perceived best courses are. But I guess the concern would be that are some universities being weakened, possibly, to serious detriment that might threaten their future existence? And are some of the universities that do the hardest work in terms of widening participation for poorer students, are they being hit financially by this system?
Mm. And just finally, the numbers on EU student arrivals, there's some very worrying signs there for what the UK may have coming in store with Brexit.
Yeah, that's right. So that was a separate batch of UCAS figures published this week, and that's for the applications to the January deadline for 2017 entry. And those show EU student applications to UK universities are down by 7%. And this is the following the UK's vote to leave the EU, and clearly that's a result of EU students deciding that the UK is not a safe option, despite the government having moved to sort of clarify the funding situation in October. Arguably that was a bit too late, so that's a big worrying sign for the future. Will those numbers completely drop off a cliff post-Brexit?
Yeah. Great, well, Simon, John, Eddie, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for listening. That's this week's issue review. A very busy week in the newsroom, as you can hear, and I'm sure this will continue. We will be following all of these stories as they develop, and many, many more. I promise not every single item in THE will be about Trump. But that's it for this week, and we'll hope to be back with you this time next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.